of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, the daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, January 18th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Chris Hedges on why he's suing President Barack Obama. Wikipedia blacks out protesting internet censorship. A book ban in Tucson, Arizona takes aim at ethnic studies programs. Plus an update on Burma and this week's activist beat.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Veteran journalist, foreign correspondent, and best-selling author Chris Hedges has filed a federal suit against the Obama administration for provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act that allows indefinite detention of American citizens. The Obama administration had initially opposed the bill, which is also referred to as the Homeland Battlefield Bill, but reversed its position when Congress passed it. President Obama, who was trained as a constitutional lawyer, signed the bill into law on New Year's Eve, saying, quote, "I have signed this bill despite having serious reservations with certain provisions that regulate the detention, interrogation, and prosecution of suspected terrorists." Obama also said, "I want to clarify that my administration will not authorize the indefinite military detention without trial of American citizens. Indeed, I believe that doing so would break with our most important traditions and values as a nation." However, even if the president keeps his promise, the new law empowers all presidents, current and future, to imprison Americans just on suspicion of terrorism, detain them indefinitely, deny them habeas corpus, and even transport them to off-site facilities. The NDAA was opposed by Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, whom Chris Hedges is also suing, and a number of other military and intelligence officials. Hedges, who in his long career as a foreign correspondent has met and associated with many foreign organizations, writes this week, "I have had dinner more times than I can count with people whom this country brands as terrorists, but that does not make me one." The lawsuit is based on the fact that being a journalist requires Hedges to undertake activities that could, according to the NDAA's vague language, possibly classify him as a person facing such indefinite detention. It is also based on violations of the First and Fifth Amendments, according to Hedges. In fact, the NDAA, which takes effect on March 3rd, is disturbingly reminiscent of the 1950 Internal Security Act passed by Congress over Harry Truman's veto, which enshrined McCarthyism. Writing for Truthdig, Chris Hedges suspects that, quote, "the real purpose of this bill is to thwart internal domestic movements that threaten the corporate state. It passed because the corporations, seeing the unrest on the streets, knowing that things are about to get much worse, worrying that the Occupy movement will expand, do not trust the police to protect them. They want to be able to call in the army, and now they can." Chris Hedges joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, President Obama has promised he will not use this law. He will, and yet he signed it. As a constitutional lawyer, he knows full well the implications of the law and the fact that it very much seems to be in violation of the First and Fifth Amendments, as you have pointed out. Why then do you think he signed it?
Well, first of all, Dianne Feinstein proposed a provision that would have exempted U.S. citizens from these measures, and it was rejected by both the Obama White House and the Democratic Party. So this is, once again, an extremely disingenuous statement. His or Obama's opposition to the wording of the bill never had anything to do with due process. We know from Carl Levin, one of the co-sponsors of the bill with John McCain, that the White House wanted executive authority to determine who would be seized by the military, denied due process, and incarcerated, in the words of the bill, until the end of hostilities, which, given our permanent war culture, is going to be a very long time. So the opposition to the bill had nothing to do with its denial of basic civil liberties enshrined in the Constitution and all about a further empowerment of the executive branch of the government. So I think that Obama's words don't, when we look closely at his negotiations with Levin's office and with the authors of the bill, don't at all match the reality of the intent. And the intent is to essentially allow the executive branch to serve as judge, jury, and executioner, as they did with the Yemeni cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. We already have, under the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act, some extremely disturbing assaults on basic civil liberties, and it, of course, is, I think, a radical interpretation of that act that has allowed the executive branch to do things like seize Jose Padilla, supposedly one of the other hijackers who didn't make it to the plane, a U.S. citizen, hold him in a military brig for 3.5 years. He was later transferred to a civilian court, but only when that detention or challenge to that detention reached the Supreme Court and questioned its legality. So this just goes one step further. It overthrows over 200 years of law, which has prohibited the U.S. military from engaging in domestic policing. It is really a truly terrifying piece of legislation. And the question is, you know, we have 1 million lawyers in this country, hundreds of law school deans. Where are they? Why aren't people whose profession is the defense of the Constitution and the rule of law speaking out?
Well, Chris Hedges, why have you taken this step? You are a writer, you're a popular speaker, you're an activist, but you are suing the government. What led you to take this particular action?
Well, because the language of the bill is so amorphous. Clearly, one of the reasons that this new legislation was passed is because it authorizes the state to carry out strikes and detain people who had nothing to do with 9/11. In the old authorization to use military force, terrorist groups were defined as those, or the terrorist groups that applied to that bill were defined as those that supported al-Qaeda or had ties with 9/11. Now we have the rise of groups, for instance, in Yemen, Somalia, other places that had nothing to do with 9/11, and many of them weren't even in existence at 9/11. The language of the bill says that those who can be charged, those who can be seized by the military off an American street, held in a military facility, denied due process, and even sent to places like Guantanamo, are those who, in the language, this is the language of the bill, substantially supports al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or what they call associated forces.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of vagueness of the language. Now, remember that in current legislation, the state, the internal security mechanisms of the state have a right or have taken upon themselves the right to investigate all sorts of people they consider to be suspects. And this would include people who store 7 days' worth of food in their home, have weatherproof ammunition, of course have weapons, are missing fingers. We have seen how previous legislation has been used to shut down Palestinian charities. In essence, what this does is not only permit that kind of persecution and closure of Islamic charities, in particular, I think, charities that assist the Palestinians, but now members of these organizations can be treated like card-carrying terrorists and sent to Guantanamo. I have spent much of my career with groups and peoples that this government defines as terrorists, whether it's Hamas or Islamic Jihad in Gaza or the old Palestine Liberation Organization. I used to meet Yasser Arafat and Abu Jihad in Tunis. I've been with the Revolutionary Guard in Iran, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK in southeastern Turkey. All of these entities are considered terrorist organizations. And what will this mean for people who send medical supplies or money to groups that attempt to assist, let's say, Palestinian or Kurdish refugees? What will it mean for peace groups that attempt to go over and speak to populations that are beleaguered by governments or repressed by governments that we are friendly with? What would it have meant for those of us who were journalists in Central America in the 1980s when we traveled with the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, the armed Sandinistas, or armed members of the Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front rebel forces in El Salvador? It's the language of the bill is such that there is no protection. There's nobody's written an exemption for journalists or anyone else.
Right. Well, and Chris,
it's really frightening.
Do you see what's happening now as part of the trajectory that arguably began with the USA Patriot Act after 9/11?
Yes, of course. It's you know, what has already happened is indefensible in terms of constitutional rights and legal protections. You know, what's been stripped away, the ability of the state, for instance, through the FISA Reform Act, to wiretap, eavesdrop, and monitor tens of millions of Americans without warrants, the denial of habeas corpus. I mean, we've already seen tremendous measures, but I think that this is a huge leap towards a kind of corporate fascism. It is really enshrining this within law. It is stripping every American citizen not only of due process, but I think finally the right of dissent, because who is it that's going to define what constitutes a threat to the state? And I think that it's a very short step from these silly measures like, you know, hoarding food or missing fingers to putting on that list some of the obstructionist tactics of the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a situation where none of the intelligence or defense agencies wanted this bill. The FBI, the CIA, the Director of National Intelligence, the Pentagon, even the Attorney General's office all opposed it. And you have to ask why. Then why did it pass? Why did it go through? And I think that, you know, and you read that last sentence from my piece in Truth Dig, I think that that is because in this corrupt and rotten corporate state that we live in, as these corporations continue the kind of plunder that they are carrying out. Remember, their response to popular unrest was to shut down the 18 Occupy encampments. It wasn't to address the grievances and injustices and suffering that led to those encampments. They want to physically eradicate them or erase them. And I think they know that things are going to get worse, especially in terms of the economy, and they want to be able to call in the armed forces when they have to. And now, of course, with this legislation, the armed forces can be inserted. It takes effect in March, in policing on our own streets.
Mm. Chris Hedges, just going back into history, I mentioned the Internal Security Act of 1950, which Harry Truman actually had the courage to veto, but then his veto was overridden by Congress. And it wasn't until 1971 that provisions from that act were then repealed and by the Non-Detention Act of 1971. And it just seems bizarre because there seem to be so many legal precedents that would stand in the way of allowing this law to stand. If your lawsuit goes all the way to the Supreme Court, it would seem to be a fairly easy slam dunk that this law violates the Constitution and wouldn't be able to stand. But then again, we're talking about a Supreme Court that hasn't always upheld citizens' rights.
Well, and we do have the precedence of Jose Padilla, that the Supreme Court refused to accept that case, rendering it moot once Jose Padilla, on the eve of the you know, on the ruling or on a potential ruling, was moved to a civilian court. I think you're right. I think under a functioning judicial system, this law wouldn't stand a chance. I'm not sure I think we're going to find out how decayed our judicial system is. And certainly the tentacles of the corporate state have not have reached deep within the bowels of the judiciary, as it has every other formal institution. Whether it is a wholly owned and fully subsidiary of the corporate state, I guess we're about to find out.
Well, Chris Hedges, I want to thank you, as always, for joining us, and we'd love to talk to you again as this lawsuit progresses. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Chris Hedges is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute, a columnist for truthdig.com, where you can read his article entitled Why I'm Suing Barack Obama. He is a veteran foreign correspondent, author of several books. His latest book is called The World As It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll get an update on the Stop Online Piracy Act and why websites like Wikipedia, Craigslist, and Google have blacked out their websites today in protest of that act. We'll also take a look at another attempt at censorship in Tucson, Arizona, where a book ban recently took effect. And then after this week's activist beat, an update on Burma as hundreds of political prisoners are released and the U.S. resumes full diplomatic relations with the military junta. Stay tuned.
Donating your car or boat is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO, and we'll take care of everything. No, really, it's that simple.
When your day is dark and the sun is cold,
Loud Silence by Delana, singer-songwriter from Sherman Oaks, California. You can find out more about her work at DelanaRocks.com, D-I-L-A-N-A, rocks.com, or check the featured music section of UprisingRadio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Users of the internet attempting to look up information from the world's most popular online encyclopedia will find they can only view their search results for a few seconds today before their screens are blacked out. Wikipedia.org's pages now read the slogan, "Imagine a world without free knowledge." It goes on to read, quote, "Right now, the U.S. Congress is considering legislation that could fatally damage the free and open internet." Urging users to contact their representatives, Wikipedia has joined many other prominent websites in a 24-hour blackout to protest the House bill Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, and the accompanying Senate bill Protect IP Act, or PIPA. Google has joined the protest with a black banner over its logo and a link saying, "Tell Congress, please don't censor the web." Craigslist.org has blacked out its front page, saying, "Corporate paymasters, keep those clammy hands off the internet." The Senate will begin voting on the PIPA Act, which is the Protect IP Act, on January 24th. And as part of our ongoing coverage of the internet censorship bills, we bring you a brief update today with our frequent guest, Holmes Wilson, co-founder of Fight for the Future, an advocacy organization against internet censorship. Welcome back to Uprising, Holmes.
Thank you.
So why today? Why have these websites, Wikipedia, Google, Craigslist, and many, many others, Reddit, why have they chosen today for this blackout? It seems coordinated, was it?
It was coordinated, and it's because we're right on the verge of a very significant vote in the Senate, where on Monday the Senate returns and will vote on closure for the Protect IP Act, which is the Senate version of the infamous SOPA, the House's censorship bill.
And so how do you think that they are going to respond to what's happening today? Because with these websites, I mean, Google, Wikipedia, Craigslist, these are huge sites with millions and millions of users using them. And presumably today's actions may result in a very, very large pushback from the public. Do you expect today's action to make a big difference?
Yes, it's definitely making a big difference. It already has. Increasingly, lawmakers are coming out and saying, saying, "What is this? We're hearing that lawmakers are telling Senate leadership, you know, what happened here? You told us that this law was going to pass easily, that it wasn't going to be controversial. People are pulling back their support, but we have to remember that the starting point on this was this bill had had dozens of co-sponsors in the House and Senate, and huge support from both parties, and there's still a distinct possibility that the other side will succeed at pushing something through, even if it's a reduced version of the bill.
Well, today is being considered the largest online protest in U.S. history. There's actually thousands of sites protesting, and it's almost like an online general strike. How unprecedented is this move? Holmes?
Okay.
Are you there? We are going to try to call Holmes Wilson back in just a second. He is the co-founder of Fight for the Future, an advocacy organization against internet censorship. We're getting an update on the two bills, one that the House is considering called Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, the accompanying Senate version of that bill, the Protect IP Act, and the Senate coming back from its recess this on Monday, on January 24th, will be taking up that act. Are you with us, Holmes?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So how unprecedented is the action, the coordinated action today, this sort of general strike on the internet?
I mean, nothing like this has ever happened in the history of the world, and it really is about the internet and everyone who uses it every day learning how to defend itself from attacks, and it's this kind of amazing kind of consciousness.
And so most websites are suggesting their users to contact their representatives. And is that what you are also recommending, that people who want to preserve the internet as it is can simply contact their representatives and urge them, both in the House and the Senate, to vote against these two bills?
That's correct. And the most important thing is that on Monday, the Senate will come back in session. And starting then, everybody should call their senator every day until their senator tells them that they are voting no on this. It's extremely important. We're also organizing in-district meetings, although the time on that is short because senators are returning to Washington on Monday.
And then how has a protest against SOPA, the House version of the bill, had an effect already? Has the House actually stopped to take a second look at this bill?
We're still hearing that the House will move forward with this in February, but the landscape has shifted dramatically. I mean, it's a much harder road there.
But the Senate is still moving forward pretty fast.
The Senate is moving forward very fast. Harry Reid still supports this, and he may still have the votes to pass something.
Well, if listeners want details about what these acts would do, they can go to uprisingradio.org and do a search for SOPA, S-O-P-A. But there's also the websites fightforthefuture.org and americancensorship.org that you've recommended on past interviews. Holmes Wilson, thanks again very much for joining us, and thanks for the update on today's online strike.
Thank you.
Holmes Wilson is co-founder of Fight for the Future, an advocacy organization against internet censorship. And we've just been discussing the very broad online strike led by websites like Wikipedia, as well as Google, Craigslist, Reddit, and thousands of other internet websites. The website that Holmes Wilson has recommended is americancensorship.org, where you can get details of these bills and why these websites are against it. In fact, any of the websites such as Wikipedia and Google also have links to why they're opposing it and where you can find the contact information for your representatives about this bill, these two bills racing through Congress. Well, we go from attempts to censor the internet to a successful attempt to censor the school district in Tucson, Arizona. Writings by Buffy St. Marie, Rigoberta Menchu, and even William Shakespeare were banned from Tucson, Arizona classrooms last week. The Tucson Unified School District Board voted 4-1 last Tuesday to allow at least 50 works, including some art pieces, to be swept from schools in order to comply with a 2010 state law that prohibits ethnic studies courses. Tucson Unified was targeted by Arizona State Superintendent of Public Instructions, John Huppenthal, last June. Huppenthal said if the district did not remove material in violation of the law, it would lose 10% of its monthly budget. Many of the works now piled in storage are by writers of Mexican and Native American descent. Winona LaDuke's To the Women of the World, Our Future, Our Responsibility was confiscated from classrooms, as well as Sherman Alexie's Ten Little Indians. Long-respected textbooks now banned include the two-decades-old Rethinking Columbus, The Next 500 Years, and Paulo Freire's celebrated work, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. One Arizona teacher told The Wall Street Journal that Shakespeare's The Tempest was banned because, quote, the likelihood of avoiding discussions of colonization, enslavement, and racism were remote. Leslie Marmon Silko's work, which is a part of a novel with a poem called Ceremony, is another banned work, and it's a tribute to the importance of storytelling. Poignantly, it includes this passage, quote, their evil is mighty, but it can't stand up to our stories, so they try to destroy the stories, lest the stories be confused or forgotten. Robert Rodriguez is my guest. He's an assistant professor at the University of Arizona and a member of the Mexican American Studies Tucson Unified School District Community Advisory Board. He's the author of two banned books, Justice, A Question of Race, and The X in La Raza. Welcome to Uprising, Roberto.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, listeners may be unaware, and Americans at large may be unaware, that this is happening in Tucson, Arizona. Arizona has generally, however, been the front line of so much sort of institutionalized racism, particularly against Latinos and Mexican Americans. How significant is what is happening in Tucson Unified? You are probably not surprised because this is something that has been in the works since 2010.
Actually, since 2006. Yeah, you're right. It's not a surprise. What is really happening here is Tom Horn, the predecessor to John Huppenthal, has labeled it a civilizational war. And he set out to ban ethnic studies beginning in 2006, and it's been ongoing. Because the hostilities in Arizona are so intense, most people have only known about the immigration issues, which are intense and severe. But at the same time, this other issue has been percolating all this time, and it just now came to a head. You know, students have run from Tucson to Phoenix, have marched, have run, have protested, have had vigils, and on and on and on, to no avail. And finally, a board, you know, I outright call them an apartheid board. You know, they voted to ban the teaching of Mexican-American studies. Now, they're fancy with words. Just, you know, all we have to do is read Orwell, and we'll know exactly what they're doing, because they're saying that it's not banned, it's simply suspended, and the books are not really banned, they're being stored, you know, things of that nature. It's really, wow. It's, you know, I've read about this my whole life. In fact, I would have compared not even to, say, the McCarthy hearings, that era, but literally an inquisition. I attended the hearings in which these books were on trial, including my own. Posters were on trial. There's a famous poster where an Aztec is pointing a finger saying, who's the pilgrim, alien? Mm. And that's been on the, in classrooms in the district. And that itself was on trial. I mean, it's like mind control. It was, I could not believe my eyes, my ears, et cetera. But again, it's not a surprise. It's just that it's the media's taken a little while to find out about it. A lot of censorship, you know, behind this.
So essentially, the school board, in order to not lose 10% of its monthly budget, have succumbed to this state law. Could they have stood up to the state?
Absolutely. This could have gone all the way to the Supreme Court. You see, one of the things to remember is that amidst all this hatred in Arizona, that this law was a genius. It was designed not to ban the program per se in terms of the way it was written, but rather it was economic sanctions. And I think we all know that economic sanctions are a tool of war. So economic sanctions are being waged upon people here in Arizona the way it's being waged in Iran.
So this is a statewide law. Is Tucson the only unified school district that has complied so far? What's happening with other school districts in Arizona?
Well, see, that's the tragedy, is that this law was created simply to eliminate the MAS program in Tucson.
Mexican-American Studies. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but the tragedy is that if another administrator comes along and says, well, I want to eliminate women's studies, or I want to eliminate whatever studies they want, they can't, because the law is there and it exists. See, it's going to be challenged all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary, but a lot of us are also mounting campaigns to the OAS and the United Nations. Because, see, we've studied this both SB 1070 and HB 2281, and we are of the firm belief that these measures are in complete violation of at least 9 international human rights treaties and conventions. We don't refer to them as laws because it would be undignified to accept them as laws. What they are is simply attempts to take the dignity, the humanity of people here in Arizona. And what I would like to remind everybody is that this is, while the attack is specific to Mexican-American studies, you know, every educator should be concerned, because the moment that we start making Swiss cheese out of what students can learn or what can be taught, then we've destroyed the very concept of education. You know, it should be the inquiry of the world, of the universe, you know, what's around us. So to be told that this is out and this is in, we've destroyed that. Hmm. And, of course, not we, but the board and the state.
Roberto Rodriguez, you wrote an article called Arizona School Officials Caught on Tape Urinating on Mexican Students, alluding to the recent scandalous video of U.S. Marines urinating on Afghan corpses that has raised a lot of attention, that has gotten a lot of national and international attention. And these 4 Marines now are being investigated and likely may be criminally prosecuted. Why do you bring this up? Why is this analogy apt?
Well, it's not unusual for journalists or columnists to take one story and write off of it, so to speak. Now, I was not unclear. You know, the word urinating is in quotes, and mm-hmm. on first mention, it says metaphorically. Mm-hmm. So I think 99.99% of people would know that this is an analogy. And what I'm even actually saying is this is worse than urinating on our community, because as I've told you, this has been going on since 2006. It's a civilizational war where we are told that we are less than human. Our history, our culture, our memories, they're not valid. You see, all of this has, when I mentioned the Inquisition, there's another concept called the Reducción, where the whole objective was to kill the Indian and create a Christian in its place. American Indians are very familiar with this concept of the boarding school. Mm-hmm. That's what this is about. We've been told, see, the original idea was that the people here were not human and that they prayed to the devil, and on and on and on. I mean, we're literally living that right now to this day. So that when kids are being told that they're less than human and their culture's not valid, I mean, urinating would probably be a compliment. You know, this is how bad it is in Arizona. It's everything that you think and worse.
And it just seems like it's very much specifically taking issue with young people learning about the real history of this country. Mexican-American studies teachers have been told to stay away from any courses where, quote, race, ethnicity, and oppression are central themes.
It's beyond that. You see, it's the concept of Western civilization. Hmm. See, the kids are taught 3 concepts. It's called Imlakesh, Panchave, and Unabku. You know, it's a maize-based philosophy, literally thousands of years old, and does not emanate from Western civilization, from Greco-Roman culture. Imlakesh means you are my other self. Panchave is to seek the root of the truth. And Unabku, roughly translated, it would be the equivalent of the architect of the universe. So they're taught that, no, just like all peoples around the world, everyone had an explanation for the universe. And so they're being taught that they're not unhuman, that they're not less than human. They're just like everybody else. And for that, that's what this is about. Mr. Horn, you know, went to the Heritage Foundation and spoke to this topic. They don't want. See, in fact, I'm not sure if you know this, but this is an incredibly highly successful program. almost 100% of students graduate from the high schools, and about over 70% go to college. Nationally, the rates, the dropout rates, are over 50% for people of color, Latino especially.
And how? Why is it that? Why does it have so much success?
Precisely because, and then there's a lot of research about this, that if the students are taught material that is familiar to them, and also if it's taught by people familiar to them, that equals success, and it's proven. Now, it just happens that these programs are open to everyone, and they're not only taught by Mexican or Mexican-American teachers. Again, we have excellent examples of people of all cultures that take these classes or teach them. But in the end, again, incredible success rate. Mr. Horn and Hoopenthal have been told about, and they know about these successes, and they say it doesn't matter what the success rate is. The thing is, they're not being taught Western civilization.
And so perhaps it is just that, the success rate, that worries them.
Precisely, because it's the old adage from Texas about what happens if you educate the Mexicans, and who's going to pick the crops. It's the same mentality. You know, that I think that freaks them out. That's where the whole thing about migration is related. See, migrants are welcome in this country to work and work for little. You know, you don't want them educated. That's what this is about. It's all, again, it's part of a much broader attack. I don't think I have to remind your listeners about the attacks that and what Arizona's been living probably since forever.
And the list of banned books that are about 50 perhaps includes Sandra Cisneros' The House on Mango Street, Jimmy Santiago Baca's Black Mesa Poems, as well as authors like Henry David Thoreau, the book Like Water for Chocolate. Does this not amount to a severe impact on just the overall education of young children, of young people and high school students and others in Arizona?
That's why I was saying that. This is an attack on all education. Mm. The very fabric of education is under threat here. Now, again, if you start to read their press releases, they're going to tell you there are no banned books.
Right.
And they won't even claim that they're confiscated. They're just banished. You know. But I've given it a term. Now, they're undocumented books, apparently. And you know, it's ironic how they the opposition manages to equate the two. So they're saying, well, they're just trying to teach illegal aliens, you know. And it's like, what? You know, but that's the mentality here. And so to me, it's like now, so if we don't have banned books, then they're undocumented.
Well, finally, Roberto Rodriguez, what do you want to happen? How do you see the path between here and reclaiming these courses and these books, either within Arizona itself or even, any sort of national effort?
Yeah. Well, several things. One, I know as a local community, or at least state community, professors, educators from throughout the state, we're going to be teaching outdoors beginning January 24th, but then after that, probably every Saturday, alternating from whether it's Horn's office or the state capitol or the state building or TUSD headquarters. And we'll teach what is. See, one of the things that's amazing is that all the opposition will say, we love your culture, we love your history, and your tacos too. We love all of that. Just keep it at home, you know. And so we're saying, no, we already did that. And that's what the whole point of ethnic studies and women's studies, all of that, that was a result of people telling us for hundreds of years to keep everything at home. So ethnic studies represents that, no, we're not keeping it at home anymore. And so we're going to go back to that. If it takes 2 years to go to the Supreme Court, we'll do that. That is, we'll teach outdoors until there's a victory. That's the beauty of this program is that a lot of people say, why don't you just start a freedom school? And we will. But the beauty of this program is that it was district-wide.
Right. Well, Roberto Rodriguez, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Roberto Rodriguez is an assistant professor at the University of Arizona, a member of the Mexican-American Studies Tucson Unified School District Community Advisory Board, the author of two books that are on the banned list, Justice, A Question of Race, as well as The X in La Raza. And we will link to his blog entry about this issue on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. After this week's Activist Beat, an update on Burma.
Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call on KALW in San Francisco with this week's Activist Beat for Uprising. Each week, I'll bring you a weekly roundup of progressive activism that the mainstream media ignores, undercovers, or misrepresents. This Sunday marks the 39th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision recognizing a woman's constitutional right to have a safe and legal abortion. Women's rights and pro-choice activists across the country are planning to mark the anniversary with rallies and demonstrations to express support for a woman's fundamental right to abortion and reproductive justice. If Republican presidential hopefuls Rick Perry, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, and Ron Paul had their way, Roe v. Wade would be overturned. These four men are so extreme, they believe abortion should be illegal even in cases of rape, incest, and threats to a woman's health. This needs to be repeated. These four men believe that abortion should be illegal, even in cases of rape and incest. They believe that if your sister or best female friend is raped, she should be forced to go through with the pregnancy. Why isn't this getting more attention? During the last presidential campaign, Republicans used the abortion issue to get votes, as they always do, but they didn't go this far. In 2008, Republican Senator John McCain, a supporter of an amendment that would outlaw abortion, was heavily criticized for pressuring the Republican Party to change its platform to recognize exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. Well, here we are just 4 years later. Perry, Gingrich, Santorum, and Paul have all signed the first personhood pledge from Personhood USA. That's the organization that's putting so-called personhood amendments on ballots across the country. By signing this pledge, these candidates support a, quote, human life amendment to the Constitution and endorse legislation to make clear that the 14th Amendment protections apply to unborn children. They also oppose assisted suicide and embryonic stem cell research. Rick Santorum is so extreme, he believes states should have the power to ban birth control. And then there's Ron Paul. Most of the coverage about Ron Paul focuses on his popular views about the military-industrial complex and the drug war. But what's missing is his extreme positions on abortion. He calls himself, quote, strongly pro-life and believes that life begins at conception and abortion leads to euthanasia. Ron Paul added an addendum to his personhood pledge, stating that the 14th Amendment has no role to play in protecting a fetus. He says he believes the state should decide. Now, it's important to note that in November, when the personhood movement backed a ballot initiative in Mississippi defining a fertilized egg as a human being, it lost by 58%. And this tells you how extreme this measure is and how out of touch these men are with one of the most conservative voting blocs in the country. Tonight in South Carolina, these men are attending Personhood USA's presidential pro-life forum. I'm guessing very few questions will be asked about what happens once the child is actually born. Their records are horrible on issues like early childhood education, children's health insurance, and child poverty. In 2010, 16 million children lived in poverty. Do these so-called pro-life candidates ever address these issues? Of course they don't. The Children's Defense Fund scores members of Congress based on how they vote on issues of importance to children. Representative Ron Paul is one of the worst representatives for children, scoring 0%. Even though the state of Texas has one of the worst child abuse records in the country, Governor Rick Perry has consistently cut child abuse prevention funding. The new motto for men like Perry, Gingrich, Santorum, and Paul should be pro-life until birth. Let's end this pro-life charade once and for all. They know the personhood amendment won't pass, but rolling back reproductive rights is now becoming normalized. So where is the outrage? Hopefully, we'll see it on the streets over the next week. I'm Rose Aguilar for Uprising.
Thanks, Rose. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. The United States government last Friday formally restored diplomatic relations with the government of Myanmar, or Burma, as it was known before the ruling military junta changed the nation's name. The restoration of relations came on the heels of an announcement that the Myanmar regime had released 651 political prisoners. Among those arrested as political prisoners in the course of many conflicts are civilian protesters, Buddhist monks, and students. A day before the prisoner release, the government announced a ceasefire in the long-running conflict between the military and ethnic Karen rebels in the east. AFP reports that a presidential order at the end of last year to end fighting against the ethnic Kachin rebels in the north failed to end the conflict there. Around the same time, though, a successful ceasefire was brokered between ethnic fighters of the Shan State Army South and its local government. In the wake of the prisoner release, Myanmar as a state was still not wholeheartedly embraced by the United Nations, which issued a statement that more reforms were needed. In contrast, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was enthusiastic, saying, quote, "This is a momentous day for the diverse people of Burma," and she announced plans to exchange ambassadors with the country. Burma has been in a state of civil war since it was declared independent from British colonial rule in 1948. State violence against ethnic minorities have caused the international community to isolate Burma by imposing sanctions against the ruling government. Hundreds of thousands of Burmese have been displaced by fighting around the nation. Meanwhile, as part of the reforms announced by President Diem Sien, elections are scheduled for April 1st. Burma's most well-known leader and Nobel Peace Laureate, Aung San Suu Kyi, who was released recently after decades of house arrest, has registered to run for office. Joining me on the phone this morning is Edith Mirante. She is a human rights activist, author of Burmese Looking Glass and Down the Rat Hole, Adventures Underground on Burma's Frontiers. Welcome to Uprising, Edith.
Good morning, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how do you respond to the U.S. government deciding to restore full diplomatic relations based on the release of hundreds of political prisoners?
Well, the United States has had diplomatic relations with Burma all along. We had a functioning embassy, which has actually been very useful for a lot of the dissidents to use as a meeting space. We just haven't had an ambassador since the democracy uprising of 1988, which was brutally suppressed by the regime. So now what will happen is an ambassador for Burma will be proposed. So it's a bit of a recognition that things have been changing in Burma, but it's not going from nothing to diplomatic relations.
Is it a little premature? I mean, the United Nations thinks more reforms are needed, but it looks like the U.S. is quite happy with the current pace of reforms.
Well, the United States is still maintaining its economic sanctions, which ban new investment in Burma and also imports from Burma, and also restrict banking with Burma, which is very important because the generals, the powers that be, have used international banking to launder their profits from multinational companies, like the United States-owned Chevron petroleum company. It's kind of funny when people talk about how isolated Burma has been in the past or the recent past, when in reality, huge multinationals have been there all along, like Chevron and Total from France, companies from democratic countries which very much disapprove of the regime and yet are heavily invested there.
So how do you explain these reforms, not just the release of Aung San Suu Kyi, but the release of these political prisoners, the fact that there's going to be elections on April 1st that Aung San Suu Kyi is going to run in? What is the motivation that the military junta has to make this happen?
Well, the pace of reform and that there's reform at all has certainly surprised analysts who've been watching Burma for decades, like I have. There was a very unfair, unfree election in 2010 in which basically military people changed into civilian clothes to become part of the new parliament. And in the new parliament, 25% of the seats are held by serving military besides that. People really didn't have high expectations of this new supposedly civilian government. But sometime around August, September, some of the people in parliament started acting like they were actual representatives and asking questions. And around that time, press censorship and internet censorship started to be lifted, and this has opened up just a huge opportunity for civil society, because this is a country that had no freedom of the press, no freedom of speech, even, you know, if you were out in public. And now all of a sudden that has opened up and blossomed. Nobody knows quite why that's happened. Aung San Suu Kyi herself has spoken of a trusting kind of a rapport when she's met with the president, Thein Sein, and a lot of this reformism does seem to come from him. So sometimes it's a leadership thing, a de Klerk or a Gorbachev who decides that it's time to reform and open up a country to a freer state.
And now I understand that even if Aung San Suu Kyi's political party wins all the 48 seats that are up for election on April 1st, it's going to have minimal power because the 440-seat lower house of parliament is very heavily weighted with military appointees, with allies of the junta. So is this a sort of a case of allowing minimal freedom just to give the appearance of reform and democracy?
Well, she's, you know, as a political leader, not someone who would be easily marginalized. And there are some very interesting people running for those seats, which were seats that were left open in the last election, including Zaire Thaw, who was a hip-hop star in Burma, which you might not think that Burma has a big hip-hop scene, but they do. And he is a former political prisoner himself. So as well as her, there are some very vocal people, very articulate and impassioned people who, if they do join that parliamentary system, it'll wake it up quite a bit. And there are some ethnic representatives already in the parliament who can kind of form a little bit of a bloc with them. And that everyone knows that they also, they have the people behind them. So they have a lot of people power besides.
So, Edith, I understand you were recently in Burma and you have been working on issues of the various ethnic conflicts with the government. How do you explain some of the ceasefires that have been signed between some of these rebel groups from various ethnic communities and the government? And is there still fighting going on?
Well, interestingly, the area where I was in November is that of the Kachin people. They live up in the north near the China and Tibetan borders. And they had been in a ceasefire agreement for 17 years and then broken off from that in fighting last summer. So that warfare is still very much going on. The town where I was in, Liza, is absolutely under siege by the government's forces. And it's led to tens of thousands of what they call internally displaced people, refugees who aren't allowed to go across the border to safety in China. So they're in very difficult situations. Now winter has come on. That's up near the Himalayas. And very, very hard situation for the civilians caught in the conflict. In other areas, negotiations with separate ethnic groups opposing the government have been more successful, and you know, fairly tentative ceasefire agreements have been reached. What the ethnic groups want, though, overall are real peace talks that would lead towards more autonomy and a federal system for Burma with the groups recognized in their own areas.
And how close is the government to essentially offering that type of freedom?
It's not that close yet, but at least they seem to have a negotiating team that's pretty willing to speak with the different groups and that seems trusted by several of the groups so far. But it's all fairly tentative.
Overall, as somebody who's been working with groups in Burma and has been following this issue, are you cautiously optimistic about Burma's future?
I am. There have been more changes for the positive side in the last few months than in the years and years that I've been involved in Burma. I think, you know, when you have this opening of some civil society, some freedom of speech, and the release of not all political prisoners by any means, but many very important political leaders who have been in prison for so many years, that does create a momentum for further change and for a further setting up of an alternative to the military rule that Burma's been under since 1962, actually.
How many more political prisoners are imprisoned? Is that number even known?
It's not really known. It varies according to you know, who is keeping track of it. There is an association for political prisoners run by former imprisoned dissidents that does think there are over 1,000 still in prison. And many of these people are on charges which are not necessarily don't seem political, but things like assisting an outlawed organization. Hmm. And that can just mean that you helped someone from a rebel group or you helped somebody from an underground group. There are many civilians who have been caught in the war zone and are held as prisoners, including women. The use of rape as a weapon of war has been constant throughout military rule in Burma, and it has continued under the present government, very much so in northern Burma where I was, and those women are captives and prisoners as well.
Well, Edith Mirante, we'd love to have you back on to follow this situation, particularly in early April when the elections take place. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Edith Mirante is a human rights activist. She's the director of Project MAGE, which you can find online at projectmaje.org. She's also the author of Burmese Looking Glass and Down the Rat Hole, Adventures Underground on Burma's Frontier. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "Change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle." That's MLK. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to all of our interviews, rate them, leave comments, share them on Facebook, and find links and events we mention on the air. Send your story ideas to mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8. Bound to tiptoe on a stiff rope bound to tiptoe on a stiff rope bound to tiptoe on a stiff rope.